So welcome everyone to the 11th annual GraduCon. This is the biggest event that the University of Chicago in terms of graduate students and postdocs runs every single year. My name is Brianna Connick. I'm Associate Director of Career Development and an office called UChicago Grad, and also the organizer for GraduCon this year. So it has been a fun ride to put everything online. This is usually a massive in-person event. So I really just wanted to say thank you to all of our panelists and our moderator for still being able to participate today. It's incredibly appreciated. So the topic for the panel discussion for the next 80 minutes, give or take, is careers in software engineering. And just to go through a little bit of kind of business is to let you know that this is our full schedule for the day. So obviously we're now at the session 3 panels. Hopefully for those of you in the audience, if you'd like to attend any interesting topics in session 4, I do have listed on the bottom of the slide the website for GraduCon where you can see the entire panel schedule as well as how to join. So thank you so much for being here. Some very quick items of business of how we're going to ask the audience to participate and engage in this format. So if you do have questions that you'd like to ask the panel, please submit them to the Q&A feature throughout at any time, really. What we're going to do is about halfway through the panel, we will start looking at that and start asking the panelists those questions. But if you are having a technical issue, I would ask that you use the chat feature for that. I will be kind of lurking in the background here and will do my best as an admitted non-IT specialist to help with any technical problems that are happening. And then to just briefly let you know who is here for our panel today. I'm not going to introduce them. They'll do that during the panel discussion. But we have an excellent group of panelists from a variety of different types of positions, as well as from different types of discipline backgrounds and degree types. And then our moderator today is Peter, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. So before we stop or start into the panel discussion, what I'd like to do is I'm going to launch a quick poll for the audience to participate. So you should all be able to see that. To really see kind of who is participating, who is here in the audience. So the first question is really what type of program, or if you're a postdoc, what are you in, and then what division you are part of as well. So we'll just allow the audience to answer this question for the next 30 seconds or so, and then I'll share it so everyone can see who's here. All right, so we have most of the votes in. Give just a few more seconds for people to vote if you'd like, and then I'll end the poll. All right, okay, gonna end the poll and share the results that the majority of people in the audience are master's students, with the next biggest group as PhD students currently. We do have some postdocs in the audience as well. And then in terms of what division everyone is coming from, the overwhelming group is from physical sciences division, no surprise there. And then the next groupings are the other STEM divisions, really, biological sciences, Pritzker School of Molecular Engineering, and we have a decent sized group from the Harris School of Public Policy. So thank you all so much for being here today. I'm going to stop this poll now and stop sharing the results. And at this point, turn it over to Peter to kick off the panel, but I'll be here in the background if there's any issues.
Thanks, Brianna. All right, well, welcome everyone. Let's get started by just going around and having all of the panelists tell us, what is it that you do? So your titles have been put out for us. But what is it in the course of your job that you actually do to help people understand where your answers are coming from and who you are? And let's start with Mayank.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a software development engineer at Amazon in Seattle, and my team is a moderation and relevance system for advertising. So if you go to Amazon website and if you are an advertiser, you want to post an ad to the Amazon website, it's my team who will make the decision of approving that ad or rejecting that ad. So we have many machine learning models which will automatically identify some features in that advertisement which is submitted. And based on those features, it will make a decision to either rejecting that ad or putting that ad on our website. So yeah.
Great, thank you. And in the course of a day or the course of a week or a month, what are the activities that you have? How do you spend your time as a person in your job?
So I'm an entry-level job, so I spend most of my time in coding on Python related to NLP or image recognition, related to machine learning, and some of my time goes to attending meetings for getting feedbacks from senior engineers in my team.
Great. Thanks, Mayank. Alyssa, can you let us know about what you're doing?
Yeah, hi. So I'm also a software engineer. I'm an application developer. So I work on our web applications. I do full stack, so that's front and back end. And my company's product is websites and applications related to digital learning and e-textbooks. What I do most of the day, since I'm also kind of in an entry-level position, is I mostly code, and I also attend meetings related to an Agile and Scrum process that we use at work. So things like backlog grooming, story pointing, other things. If you're familiar with Agile, those will probably make sense to you.
Okay. Thanks. Sangjin, you have a different title. How is it that, you know, what is it that you're doing, and how do you spend your time at your job?
Sure. Actually, I was an individual contributor, software engineer, up until about 2 years ago. So I was actually a coder, programmer, developer, you name it, for a long time. And then, you know, recently I made a transition to a management position. So that's what I've been doing in the past couple of years here at PayPal. So I work at PayPal as a senior director of a platform engineering team. So my day is probably more consumed by meetings than other things. So I sit in front of meetings just like this, like 5, 6, 7 hours a day, which I'm getting used to. It's really about you know, setting the vision for the team, really taking care of the team, you know, building, mentoring. These things are really more of the main activities that I do lately.
Great, thank you. And I understand the sort of the shock of that transition.
Yeah, that's still very fresh on my mind.
Instead of developing, it was a major culture change. Thanks very much. Lionel?
Yeah, sure. So I have two jobs for now. The first is that I've just joined the faculty of the master's program in computer science as a lecturer. So I'm teaching my first class on Monday, or rather having my first online discussion section. I also am the head of engineering at a financial research startup called Tegas, the daily activities I actually have are very similar to Sanjin's. I would say I also spend a large amount of time interviewing engineers. I'd say it's 70% to 80% of my job right now is hiring related as we try to grow our team. I'd also make two more comments. One is that Sanjin, I actually worked for Braintree, which is owned by PayPal, for 7 years, where I was a senior manager there when I left. So I don't think we've met before, but there you go, small world. And I also realized that I'm wearing the same shirt in right now as I am the photo that I sent to the people in the slideshow.
Because you're really busy.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, great. Thank you. All right. Well, hopefully that helps people understand where you all are coming from and, you know, in the future, directing some questions to folks. I'm curious, and this is maybe also a round robin I'd like to do. I'm curious about your origin stories. I mean, what is it that had you go into software engineering? What's the trajectory that, you know, that got you into this field? And, you know, maybe a little bit to your current job, but we'll talk more about that later. But, put yourself back in the shoes of someone who's graduating, you know, how would you pick that program? What was it that appealed to you and made you pursue this particular thing? And let's just continue with you, Lionel.
Sure. So I have a bit of an odd segue here. So I went to a small liberal arts college where I studied math and English and didn't really know what I was going to do when I finished. And I ended up like senior year, I took a programming class, but didn't really know what I was going to do. So I moved from New York to California. I got a job at a six-person startup in Mountain View. Just kind of thought I was living the life. You know, I was like, had seven roommates living on like not a lot of money in an expensive area. And Facebook came in. So it was a six-person startup. Everyone except for me was an engineer. I was effectively like a technical writer. So we would do usability studies and I would write up the results of the study for the client and kind of deliver it to them. The business model of the company did not work. We ran out of money after 4 months of me being there. The company was in business for like, I don't know, a year and a half. Facebook came in. They really wanted to acquire the engineering team. They specifically negotiated not to acquire IP, which really tells you what they were after. And my boss, so I was 22. My boss, the president of the company, would set me down. He was 24. He was like, look, Lionel, Facebook doesn't want our blogger. The technical writer is not coming with us. Sorry, like, wish you the best. And so I sort of thought to myself, like, well, if I'm going to be living in the Valley and so forth, I should learn to program. So I started to do it online. I eventually got like very much an entry-level internship at kind of like a sister company, a company that had gone to the same accelerator as my previous job. And the process began from there. I ended up moving to Chicago, getting a job at Braintree where I spent most of my career. And then pretty quickly realized I wanted to get more formal training in computer science. And so that's how I entered the MPCS. Anything I missed?
I don't know. It sounded pretty good. Actually, we've got to talk about this at some point. I've got some very similar aspects of my trajectory.
Yeah.
But all right, great. Thanks. That's very helpful. Sangjin, can you fill us in?
Yeah, sure. I thought that my experience was also pretty unconventional, but hearing Lionel's story, I think that is also pretty interesting. So actually, I started out in the field of physics. I was not close to computer science, and that's actually how I went to the University of Chicago. I was in my graduate school. I was actually a trained theoretical astrophysicist. That's what I was doing there. But then, there are a number of sort of interesting events that happened as I graduated from the university and I was starting my research career. I basically came to a point where I really had to make a kind of life-changing decision. And then that's actually when I thought about, hey, actually, maybe writing computer code and software might be something in the future. So I started looking into this and, after a few conversations with my friends, referral after referral, that's actually how I started my software career. My first company in the Valley, this is a really long time ago, 1998, that was the time. My first company in the Valley was actually Netscape. You might have heard of that company. So I just stumbled onto that company. I basically started from scratch because I didn't really have formal training in computer science or programming. What I could lean on was pretty much what I self-taught in programming as part of my research career, because theoretical physics involves really heavy dose of programming. And that's really how I got my career started. But it was really starting from, level one. That's actually how I got started there. Long story short, that's actually how my career progressed. So many after interesting transitions later, basically that's actually what I'm doing right now.
Okay. Thank you, Sanjay. Alyssa, how about you? How did you get started?
So I will also say that my story is perhaps somewhat unconventional. And the reason that I started coding in the first place is actually a little bit embarrassing. I was a public policy student at UChicago, and coding was something I never considered because I thought you had to be really good at math, and I just wasn't all that good at math. But my boyfriend was a computer science major, and I had no idea what he was doing all the time, and I wanted to be able to talk to him about his work because I don't like feeling stupid. So I just started at a summer internship that I had that was very boring. I started doing Code Academy online, and I just picked up some stuff and I really liked it. So I took a class the following year. It was Computer Science 101. It was called Introduction to the World Wide Web. Great class. I learned how to make web pages, and then I found the CAP program through the Harris School, and I thought that would be a really good transition for me because of my background in public policy. And I realized pretty quickly that CAP was very focused on data science, but what I actually enjoyed doing was more software engineering. I liked building applications that had users, that had like a UI UX aspect to them instead of using pandas to look at data trends and stuff. And that stuff is great, and I really appreciate all the stuff that data scientists do, but it just wasn't for me. So I took a lot of MPCS classes in my second year, and I liked those a lot better. And when I started looking for jobs, I applied to a job at Capital One, and that was the first interview that I did, and I got the job, and I just took it because I didn't want to deal with the pressures of trying to find a job while trying to graduate and being a dual degree student. It was a lot. But I think that job actually set me up really well because it was a development program intended for new college graduates. So they gave us a lot of support in terms of how to really become a software engineer. And I think that was a really good decision for me.
Okay. Thank you. So we're seeing a trend here about getting into this. How about you, Mayank?
Yeah, so I was having the same kind of story. My bachelor's degree was in civil engineering, not computer science. But during my bachelor, someone told me that you can learn building websites, building applications in your free time. So I started teaching myself how to build websites, how to build Android app applications through some online courses on Udacity, Coursera, and websites like that. So after that, I really liked programming, and I contributed to some open source projects for Android app applications. And after that, I thought that I want to go to computer science. So I applied in MPCS, and I got accepted. So then I started my formal degree in computer science. And during the MPCS, I interned at Goldman Sachs in summer 2019, where I worked on building full stack web applications. And after that internship, I applied to some other companies and I got accepted in Amazon. Yeah.
Great, thank you very much. All right, so let me ask you all to build off of that a little bit. Everyone came into this with the trajectory that wasn't necessarily a completely predictable, I'm going to get a computer science degree, I'm going to get a software job. So how did your graduate program relate to your career? What is it? What did it provide that you've been able to leverage? Was there benefits of, as Sanjit said, in physics, he had to do a lot of mathematics. But were there things that you've been, a lot of coding, sorry. Are there things that you've been able to leverage? Is there perspective that you've gotten? What I've seen is that a lot of folks get into software engineering career from very diverse backgrounds, and I think this panel just proves that out. And yet there's a lot of benefit to that because the job of software engineer, or all of the jobs in the field, they're complex. They're, you're part of a larger human enterprise. And so I'd just like to hear what it is that you've been able to bring in from your graduate education. And along the way, is there anything you'd wish you'd known while you were a student or while you were looking for a job, in terms of taking that experience that you have as a graduate student and translating it to something which can be helpful to folks who are either trying to understand what the right job is or understand, the best actions they can take to get that job. Does anyone want to jump in on that?
Okay. Well, if no one else is going to jump in, I suppose I can. So this is an interesting question for me because I did CAP and I'm not really doing all that much related to public policy or data science right now, which are the two main focuses of that program. I would say one thing that I really liked about an interdisciplinary program like CAP is that it gave me a lot of knowledge in fields that aren't strictly like programming. And that made it easier for me to talk to people in interviews about things that weren't related to the job. So I was able to present myself as a very well-rounded person who had interest and knowledge and insight about related fields and related technologies. And that really helped me get my second job, the job where I am now, because of all my experience in policy working at a company who builds software for universities and colleges to use across the US. There is a lot of policy there. They have to deal with bills coming from the Department of Education and laws about student privacy. And when I applied for that job, I really leveraged my background in some of the policy related things to say, hey, I know I'm a coder and I'm applying for a coding position, but I think I can bring a lot to your company because I'm not just going to sit at my desk and write code. I'm going to be interested in our mission. I'm going to be interested in the wider concept of the company and the direction where we're going. And I think I can provide insight. So that's where having a background in something in addition to computer science really helped me. And as for things I wish that I had done, I wish I had taken the chance to do some research, like work as a research assistant, because when I think about continuing my education and potentially applying to a doctoral program, that's a big issue for me because I don't have a lot of experience there, and I wish I had pursued that a little bit more.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful. Very few software jobs write software for the sake of writing software, right? It's almost always to achieve some other goal in the world. And so all of the background that we can bring in, whether it's with particular types of science or particular types of the business activities, all of it plays into helping us be better at that role. So that's great. That's really helpful. Thank you.
And I can also maybe talk a little bit about that. First of all, I feel kind of bad for the computer scientists in this audience because all of us seem to be actually starting from a different point of view. But one thing that I could translate from my physics education was really more about things like general problem-solving discipline or problem-solving skills or being able to use your intuition to have a good grasp of the problems at hand. I think those things really helped me immensely. And I think they are a very transferable skill from, one part of science or engineering to another. So I think that is actually something that really helped me along the way. That said, I basically had to learn a lot of the computer science fundamentals basically by myself because, I was already out of school. I really had to sort of bootstrap myself into the industry that I was in. And, I basically suffered a, number of years of imposter syndrome because, I wasn't really, proficient at some of the algorithms that people are talking about. I just had to go and hit the books to learn it myself. So in that sense, having a sort of fundamental building blocks and foundations in computer science, I think that's actually still an immense benefit.
Thank you. Anyone else want to take that one? All right, so as you progress in your careers, the days of the career escalator are largely gone, right? We all have to take a certain amount of ownership as we go forward and kind of help chart our path, regardless of how helpful our company is. And a lot of companies were very helpful in this regard, others not so much. But as you got to the point you are now, are there any stories you could share or ideas you could share about how you take control of what it is, of your career path as you go? Have any of you had specific experiences that you can share that might be helpful to folks in our audience here?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts on this. I think that I could probably identify two or three more pivotal moments. Once I started working at a growing company, it's pretty, especially early on, I think it makes a lot of sense to just focus on learning to do the job well. You don't really have to worry too much about what am I angling for long term here. I think spend the first couple of years of your career just like learning to program well, learning to be able to deliver stuff, that sort of thing. But I had a couple moments where I was like, had opportunities to go work at smaller companies once I had received some training. And like, I think that eventually I ended up taking that, and that was really helpful. Like, I think that I think it's really hard to start out at a tiny company where there's no one around to really help teach you. But I think that it's a really fun thing to do once you're more established. I think you asked a couple different questions while answering one of them. In terms of specific moments, there was one time when I like threatened to quit unless they promoted me. So that can work if you're sure that it'll work.
That's ready to walk.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm struck by that that distinction that you made about, you know, out of the gate, make sure you sit down and learn. Does anyone have recommendations about how it is that you can continue learning? Because, you know, one of the sad truths is we teach people as well as we can when they're in school. And then it's like, you know, getting hit with a bucket of cold water when you go into the actual workplace and you're dealing with all sorts of issues that never came up in class because, you know, the world of doing professional coding is very different than the world of doing assignments. And I know that in some of the programs at the university, certainly in the MPCS, we take a lot of time to try to make things somewhat realistic, you know, with teamwork and using industry tools and things like that. But do you have advice for people who are sort of just trying to jump across that chasm right now? They've got some training, but now they're immersed in the real world. So Sanjin's had hit the books. You know, what is it that we can do to help make sure that we become increasingly better at our technical jobs?
Yeah, so actually one thing that comes to mind right now is this thing called open source projects out there. And I think this is still a relatively recent phenomenon, maybe in the past 10, 15 years that really, you know, came to prominence. And I think this is really a really rich field of opportunities because there are so many interesting things out there, either on GitHub or even in Apache Software Foundation. There are lots of specific, you know, concrete manifestations of problem solving, constant new things that are coming up there. And many of these projects really want, you know, contributors, people from all over the world that can contribute and that can actually make an impact. And they're usually governed by meritocracy. So if you have great ideas, even if you have some code changes and things that you can do, you can actually get your feet wet that way pretty quickly. I'm also drawing from my experience as well. I also got introduced to a couple of early Apache projects in my career. There was a project called Apache Mina that was some time back that actually did a asynchronous IO framework for Java-based projects. And I got introduced to that. And I started with a couple of patches, but that really helped me understand better in terms of what are the concrete things I can do, and I can learn through that. And during the interaction, I can also build a little bit of credibility in terms of the things that I can do. And those usually give you one of the more concrete ways sort of to build your sort of strength and also credibility to help you along the way in your career.
That's really, really interesting, Sanjin. Can I dig into that a little further? I think that some folks might be daunted or intimidated at the prospect of finding a project in the Apache family, you know, something open source and working on it. How did you start doing that? I mean, what's the beginning of that like? Looking at a project, were you using something and you found out that maybe you had an improvement to the open source code? Did you specifically look at bug lists on the public repositories and just see if you could solve a few of those? How does someone get into doing that kind of a thing?
Yeah, so that's a great question. For me, it was actually more driven by the company and the project that I was doing. So I was actually working at eBay at the time, and we actually had a project of solving some problem that the company wanted to solve. And then we actually went out and looked at the number of open source offerings out there, and we chose that particular project. So the moment we started using that, we found some bugs. We also discovered bugs that are already on their Jira list of issues. And as part of my doing my job, I basically needed to fix those issues. So they started small, fixing really small, tiny bugs, sometimes even contributing some small patch in terms of even fixing documentation. Things can start really, really small, but once you start establishing your presence there, basically one thing can lead to another. And that's actually how I got started. But I think the situation today is actually so much better. At that time, I was driven more by the company initiative. These days, there are just so many projects on even GitHub. There are just too many for you to really make sense out of them. But it also means that there's just so many opportunities there. It's really up to your sort of, on your fingers in terms of search of the right projects to get involved in, whether they are related with your day job or not. So I think that is the opportunity is probably even more than before.
Great, thanks a lot. Does anyone else have any other things that they do to stay on top of either new developments in the field or making sure that they're sharpening the tools that they already have outside of just the daily responsibilities of work?
Yeah, I can say something about open source too. So when I was getting a degree in civil engineering, I started contributing in open source. So there was a program called Google Summer of Code, which encourages programmers to contribute in open source. So I contributed to that program. So if anyone wants to contribute in open source, that person can go to Google Summer of Code website, and there are so many projects listed in literally every domain in every programming languages. So anyone can pick any project and go to the issues list, and every organization has different standard of programming. So I remember when I had submitted my first patch, it took 15 days to be accepted in that patch because there are so many rules like variable names, class names. Every organization have different set of rules. And even in the industry, every company has different set of rules for programming. So open source is the best way to learn how the software engineering works in the real industry.
Okay, great, thank you. So another endorsement for open source. And Google Summer of Code, great resource, thank you. Let me change our focus a little bit. So some of you are hiring managers, some of you likely participate in interviews. When you're interviewing potential colleagues or employees, talking to candidates for jobs at your organization, what are the things that stand out at you? What makes you sit up and take notice of a particular candidate? I'm going to start this one with you, Lionel. Is there anything that jumps out, or for that matter, is there anything which is a red flag when you're looking?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think if I could step back a little bit and talk about software engineering a little bit in general. Josh Blackwood ran like a great panel on this a couple times that I was lucky enough to go to. I would say that like one thing I would just note about software engineering interviewing and hiring is how extremely broad and diverse the styles of interviews you see, and the expectations that different companies and different hiring managers have. So I find it generally hard to give categorical advice. Like I can tell you what I like, but I'm just looking at the QA, there's a lot of questions like, should I do lead coder or something like that? And it's like, I feel like I can say, well, I don't really care about that sort of thing, but I'm also pretty sure that there's probably a hiring manager at the company next door who cares about it quite a lot. So I think that like any subsequent statements have to be couched in that I think that like the overall best thing to do if you're looking to get a job at a specific company is figure out what that company in particular does and then go figure out how to do that better. Because first of all, these companies will tell you their hiring processes. It's typically very easy to get that information if you're trying. And second of all, like I don't think we can guarantee that aside from just general interviewing skills, things often do not transfer from one process to another. But yeah, I think what I would say I look for is like, I'm looking for people who are looking to solve problems in particular. They're not looking to box themselves into specific technologies. That is a sort of a non-obvious red flag. Like, I think I'm trying to think of red flags that are not just like kind of trivial mm-hmm. stuff that you can think of yourself. Like, so I would say never describe yourself as like, I'm a Java developer. It's like, you're a person who can use software to solve problems, and it's fine to have a preference of which technologies you enjoy using, but like, don't try to steer your career in such a way where you're only trying to like only ever do one technology, because the nature of this industry is that it's like that stuff will change and something will become obsolete. So I tend to look for people who are generalists, who are looking to get things done rather than sort of navel gaze around specific technologies. And just sort of like people I would like to work with who I kind of inspire me, like who are generally like just seem very competent. I don't know. Nothing super special beyond that.
Okay. I mean, I think the most heated debate around hiring really has to do with if we're hiring, let's say, a developer, are we hiring a developer who has a deep skill set specifically in this technology for the role? And the job postings always say that, right? There's very few job postings that say, we'd like a software developer. It's a job posting says we want a software developer with 5 years of Java or, with 2 years of Python or whatever. And yet, when you talk to hiring managers so often, I hear what you're saying, which is at the end of the day, if it's someone who can learn and has an ability to adapt and use technology to solve problems, they're really in the long run going to be a better fit for the team. But there's a trade-off, right, with specialized skills. So I
would definitely acknowledge that there are roles that require really specialized skills. Like if you're going to hire to work on the Linux kernel, like you need to know how to do that. Like that's different. But I think that like what a lot of people react to is that there is a large amount of software engineering jobs that are different areas of web application development, where it's like some people are working on user interfaces or something, some people are working on server-side technologies, some people are working on database integrations or cloud systems or whatever. And those are all like sub niches within themselves, but there's a lot of things in common as well. But I definitely acknowledge there are niche jobs, yes.
All right, thanks. Sanjay, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I think I agree with most of what Lionel just said. Companies have very different style of interviews. They focus on a little bit different things. So I don't know that there's a very strong general statement one can make. But that said, problem-solving skills, sort of strong intellectual horsepower, those things usually translate really well. I think those are because, the problems you're solving may change and the things you do may change, but if you have that sort of fundamental intellectual capacity, you'll do pretty well. So those are really good skills to have. Another dimension I'm going to call out is actually sort of non-technical side of things. I think they tend to be underestimated, maybe coming from schools and from the candidate perspective. But I think that is actually something that we do really look for in terms of signals. Because one thing I do say is software engineering is a team sport. It is not an individual sport. And how you really work well with others, how you really make people around you better, is really, really an essential skill. So in terms of your communication, in terms of your way to sort of handle conflicts and things of that nature, I think those are really important. And we are also on the lookout for picking up those signals, not only your technical skills. I mean, technical skills are foundations for sure, but we are also on the lookout for those non-technical signals to really round out the view of you.
Okay, great, thank you. Alyssa or Mayank, do you want to comment on that?
I actually wanted to say I wholeheartedly agree with everything that's been said, especially the focus on the non-technical side of things. If you're applying for a software engineering position, obviously you need to know how to code, but I think sometimes something that gets lost is, especially in an interview when you're very focused on just getting the right answer, is that passion and drive that you have. And I think a lot of companies really look for that. In my experience, I would say that in just sort of a general way, very large companies tend to be maybe more focused on the technical aspects, at least in the first, second round of interviews, whereas the small companies I've interviewed at tend to be a little more focused on how do you fit in at the company? Like, do we want to work with you? And I think that's just sort of the nature of the companies as well. I remember like one interview I sat on, and I'll be very vague because I don't want to, you know, give any information that could lead to any identification of anyone or anything. But in one interview, there were two people. There was one person who did really well on our code challenge, but kind of faltered in sort of the team and company fit part. And when we threw kind of coding curveballs at this person to see how they would respond, they didn't necessarily respond very well. And there was another person who sort of came from like a non-traditional background, like a more boot camp type situation, who was missing a lot of gaps in technical knowledge and didn't do as great on the first part of the code challenge, but their drive and their passion and their desire to learn when we asked them some more probing questions about, hey, what would you do in this situation? They didn't necessarily know the answer, but they wanted to discuss it with us, and they wanted to learn. And that, I think, was the deciding factor. We all sort of came to the consensus that we'd rather have the second person on our team, even if there were some like more considerable gaps in their technical knowledge, because they just seemed like a person we really want to work with, a person who had the desire to learn, which we didn't get from the first person that we interviewed. So I think the interpersonal soft skills are a bigger part than a lot of people think.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I also think that non-technical skills are must. So when I was doing internship in Goldman Sachs, one of my teammates told me that programming is the easiest part of the software engineering job. And there is a stark difference between class assignments and engineering job is that class assignments, we have a specific target that we need to program this and we need to get this result. But in software engineering jobs, there is a huge vagueness in the task. So we need to ask team members that what should we achieve and how should we achieve. Sometimes requirement change in the middle of the project. So we should also know how to handle those change.
Yeah. Okay, great. That's very helpful. Thank you. I'd like to switch our attention over now to some of the questions that are coming in. There have been a great number of questions about certain topics, but the thing which is the current, let's start with the current leader. Besides algorithm and coding or programming, what sorts of topics should we focus on? In other words, cloud computing, discrete math, et cetera. What is there, and I guess this means for folks who are still in school, that attendees can focus on now that might really pay off when the time comes to graduate and to be finding a job? And I'll leave that open for anyone who wants to jump in if you think there's a particular field or a particular topic of study that's especially worth pursuing right now.
I'd answer this best, I guess I could describe like what the way I think about interviewing people a little bit. Like what we do is we definitely ask for someone to describe their background, and we look, we do sort of like micro level programming exercises with them where we sit down and it's like, here's a small programming problem, let's work through it together. And that kind of gives you exposure, like, you know, can they code? Do they at least have some understanding of big O notation? We're not really asking them to do like a dynamic programming problem on the fly or anything like that. But then another thing that we ask people to do is, hey, describe a system that you've worked on and like draw out an arc, like a network diagram of like what part was talking to what and in what way. And let's talk about like, hey, if the scale increased by 100x, what would you have to do? Or if this invariant that you had been relying on in the system design was changed, like what would you have to do? And I find that it's possible to be good at just like sitting at your desk and programming and not really understand how to reason about how systems build it up and change and evolve. And so my answer would say, if you feel like you're already good at just like literally programming, understanding system design is sort of the next thing that I'll make sure that you're able to do. So if you're to just connect that to specific classes, I would say networks, databases, cloud computing, distributed systems, operating systems to a certain extent. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anyone else want to weigh in on that? Okay. Well, let's take the next one. After you obtain your first job, how important is it to maintain a public GitHub, e.g. when you're looking for a new position elsewhere? So how important is it to have that public portfolio of the work that you've done?
Okay, I can take a stab at this one as well, and then I'll let someone else go. But this is exactly the type of question that is, I don't think it's possible for us to give categorical answers to. Like, I can tell you that I do not look at people's GitHub profiles when I'm looking at them for a job. I'm confident in the rest of our interview process. I can also tell you that I have a good friend who has a very similar job to me. He's the head of engineering at a growing startup who definitely does look at your GitHub. And I don't know what Sanjay is going to say he does. And if we had a bunch of other people who are hiring managers, I don't know what they would say either. So sorry.
Honest. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's you know, job seekers are often advised to work up their GitHub profiles. And I think it varies highly whether people look at it. Sanjay, you want to tackle it with that?
Yeah, I also agree that, you know, it really varies. It depends on also what you're doing in those GitHub repositories. And I cannot promise that, you know, all the hiring managers will look at your GitHub profiles religiously. That probably doesn't really happen. And I think there are also pitfalls too. Especially what I would say is that, you know, pay attention to how you interacted with people that came to your GitHub repositories. And these things, you know, this is basically your track record out there. And, you know, if you happen to get into some kind of flame war, that's not going to go too well for you, right? So I think, again, kind of going back to the theme of really being also technically strong as well as non-technically, you know, people can look at both sides of the equation. And if there are certain projects you really feel very proud of, and that can really showcase your talent, and also you're really passionate about that, then, you know, by all means, just keep working on it. But, you know, otherwise, if this is really more to really kind of polish your sort of picture out there, I think that'll really depend on the situation.
Do you think it matters the level of seniority of the programmer that you're looking for? Do you think people are more inclined to look for entry-level or experienced programmers to see if they have a repository in public?
So if you are more of an entry-level candidate, maybe it works as more of an attention grabber. So I think maybe there's a little bit of value in that. But what I don't know is whether people will actually dig deeper into the nature of the project and what you're doing and trying to draw a lot of information out of it. So that'd be my thinking. You know, there's also an exceptional category of situations. For example, you know, imagine something like AmpLab coming out of Berkeley. You know, they did things like Spark. They did things like Mesos. These are really, in a way, kind of groundbreaking projects that they put out there as part of their research. If you're part of that, I mean, that's more of an exception, right? Then it's definitely something that'll really attract people's attention, and they'll actually dig deeper into what you did on those projects.
Great, thank you.
I just want to jump in and say one thing really quickly for this. I don't maintain my GitHub. I haven't since I left school. And that's because I have a really strict no code at home protocol for myself, because I like to maintain a strong work-life balance, and I have many other hobbies that have nothing to do with coding. And that's me personally. And if you like coding in your free time and you want to do that, then that's great for you. But if I were to apply to a job and they were very concerned that I didn't have many commits over the past 2 years in my public GitHub, I would tell them that that's why. And if they pushed back against it, I wouldn't pursue it further, because if I, like, I don't want to work for a company that expects me to be coding for 18 hours of the day. When I come home after work, I don't code. That's my own personal desire. So I think it really depends on what you want. If you like to code in your free time and you think that's important, for employers to know, then it's worth to maintain it. And if you don't, then, you know, don't. It's fine. Like Lionel and Sanjan said, it really varies. I know I've probably missed out on jobs, but I'm not sure that they're jobs that I would actually like want to pursue. So.
Okay. Thanks, Lissa. So let's see. Our currently up top voted question, how does one pivot from a data science career pathway, which includes some coding, to a career in software engineering? Should one look for entry level some SDE jobs or something slightly higher than that? And I think this is this question could be generalized a bit. I mean, let's specifically try to address it from data science if you folks have insight into that. But you know, there's a lot of folks who have been in software engineering adjacent, right, or software development adjacent roles. And they do have some professional trajectory there, but now they want to switch. I've encountered that a lot of times over my career. What's your recommendation on this panel? I mean, should folks start from the beginning?
I would say the best way is to find someone in your team who is working as a software engineer and ask them to get help from them. So basically, in my team, we have product managers, we have applied scientists. So once I was asking that, I'm interested in product management and how can I get into that? So one of my product manager told me that if you want to be a product manager, I can help you. I can give you some projects and you can go through them and you can just think that, is this the right field for me? So yeah, I would say that the best way is find some software engineer in your team or in your community and ask them what kind of projects they work on and is software engineering the right thing for you? Yeah.
So there's a lot of benefit in if you can leverage your current environment where you already have a reputation and you already have support to be able to leverage that as opposed to maybe going back to the beginning of the ladder at another company, right? That can help. Now, if you can find that kind of support outside of your current role and they can help you transition, that's great too. Otherwise, you have a classic resume challenge, which is you're trying to do a little bit of a career shift and you just need to find a way to position what you've been doing. Then it comes down to how well you can make that case. But I've seen many times people who do this transition, if they do it inside their company, they can leverage all of the good reputation they have, all of the connections that they have inside of the company. If they've been an IT person who's been able to help out the software team, then having built those relationships really helps them make that transition. So just to add a little bit to what you said, Maya, thank you. Okay. And this idea of switching from one role to another, you know, or your previous comment, Alyssa, about maybe not wanting to work for a particular company, as you're interviewing or just casing out places, how can you tell if you found a good fit? I mean, what are the sort of considerations? There's a lot of big names out there, but there's workplaces that are a better fit or a less good fit for different people and different temperaments. What is it that you've learned about how you can tell if a job is going to work for you?
Are you asking me specifically?
I'm asking everybody, but I'm happy to start with you.
Okay. Well, one of the things that, and I think this is very particular to me and sort of is based on like a lot of different things, like my political opinions and my like belief on how companies, you know, should treat their employees and stuff like that. But I guess big red flags to me are companies that, this relates to my last comment, that expect you to be just sort of coding all the time. That's not something that I would want out of my life. And one thing I always try to bring up in the sort of, do you have any questions for me part of the interview is, what does work-life balance mean to you? What does it look like for your team? You know, what are your expectations around staying late if there's a huge bug, et cetera? And if the response is sort of related to or sort of, well, you know, we do what it takes to get the job done. We don't have a policy. You know, we encourage people to, you know, work really hard. We like to see, you know, really strong work ethic. Those are all good things. And I would expect that anyone, any company would expect that. But sort of when it's said like that, it's a little bit of a dog whistle to me, especially if you're, it occurs on like job postings too. Like if you see the words like self-motivated, able to work on extremely tight deadlines with little instruction, to me what this is saying is they don't have a team ready to support you. And if I get the same feel in an interview with sort of like, yeah, well, we expect people to be able to shift priorities at the drop of a hat, to me that is very concerning. And to me that says, I wouldn't be on a team with a lot of support. I wouldn't have a good work-life balance. I would probably be stressed. So that's something I always try to ask about in interviews. And for me, that's very important because I value my personal time. Other people, maybe it's not as important to them, but it is important to me.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I'd also like to add a little there. So I think, you know, for the people that are in this room, I suspect that you still have choices out there because, you know, you're coming from one of the best universities, the best university in the country. you will have, you know, more than one opportunity out there. So it's actually as much you picking the company as the company picking you too still. And I think one thing I would say is that, you know, do your homework. I think of three things that are really important, at least to me. It has been important to me when I change jobs is the first thing is about the company mission. If I don't believe in the company mission, then probably I'm not going to be very happy in that company, right? So that, I think that is number one. Number two, great leadership. The CEO and the key leaders of the company, do they know what they're doing? Can they run a successful company? Because no matter how great the work your work is, if the company is going down the drain, then probably you're not going to be happy there either. So great leadership is number two. Number three is great culture. I think there are ways for you to actually find out what kind of culture the company is known for. And you know, if what you're hearing is not really great in terms of the toxic work culture, you know, inclusion or any, you know, what have you, if you're really hearing red flags in those, then probably you're not going to be very happy in that company. So, you know, not only you prepare for the technical interviews and try to ace them, but you also want to be knowledgeable in terms of some of the key elements about the company going in, even before going to the interview, so that you have a reasonable idea of what you're walking into.
Great, thank you. Good advice.
Glassdoor, the website, is a really good way to look up what employees are saying about a company, just FYI. I always look on Glassdoor.
Thanks. So I guess the elephant in the room is right now we have the coronavirus complicating everything and creating tragedies left and right. We've got a lot of interest from the audience, and if there's any advice for what you do if you're looking for a job, if you're entering the job market during the coronavirus era. And a following question, how has it impacted software companies? Can any of you speak to that? Are you all still hiring?
So I'm, my company is in the unique position of like, we are actually probably not going to be affected that much. But I think what I would say is that, okay, first of all, it's bad. Like, let's just acknowledge that this situation really sucks, both from the human toll of the virus and also because like we're just clearly going into a recession. I think the way to that might help people think about it is don't think about like tech versus like non-tech, but instead think about like what is the company doing and how is that likely to be impacted by the particular nature of the economic slowdown we're seeing. So like one way, a very specific thing you think about is like cash flow cycles. So like the company I work for, we get paid by businesses upfront for annual contracts. We're not experiencing that much of a cash flow problem. If I worked for, I'll just pick on OpenTable. OpenTable gets a fee probably monthly from restaurants that it partners with, and then it also gets a kickback every time someone books a meal on OpenTable. Well, uh-oh, right? Because that just went down the drain. So I would say if you're going to be on the job market in the next couple of months, like, I would maybe think about, like, look at job postings, because that this also does this stuff for you, but think about, like, what, like, probably industries or verticals that you can look at rather than just sort of like a tech job versus not tech job. There's also a lot of resources in the Chicago area that can help you with this. There's like the Chicago area tech Slack or something like that, that has, there's a lot of people on these things that maintain lists of like who's still hiring, who's not, who's had layoffs, that sort of thing. And then there's also like national companies that will put out like kind of surveys in response to the economic events like that. So there's one by this company, Candor, candor.co, which it's this weird company where they like help you negotiate your offer as a service, but they have this like list of, it's like this Airtable spreadsheet they made of like 1,000 companies, like major tech companies, and like what are they doing as a result of the coronavirus thing. And so you can see like, oh, like, you know, certain divisions of PayPal are having hiring freezes, but not all of them. You know, Venmo is still hiring in Chicago. I don't know if Braintree is. So things like that.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, so just one quick comment. So I think, you know, I'm 100% in agreement. This is going to be really industry by industry. I think it's going to be really vertical industry picture. If you look at the aggregate demand for software engineers, I don't know that that's going to decrease because, you know, actually, even as a result of this, a lot of our interactions and our way of living will become probably more online than offline. So I think there's still going to be a constant need of strong sort of, you know, IT slash tech slash software industry. So so the aggregate demand might not go down, but it's going to be really more about, you know, what type of industry that might present more opportunities. You know, you can think of things like FAANG as kind of a safety choice, you know, in a way, because they will just continue to hire. And yesterday I saw a news article that said Facebook is going to hire 10,000 people this year. But just, you know, really crazy. So you can think of maybe FAANG as kind of a safety choice, but I think there's still enough interesting opportunities there in a medium to large companies that would have a pretty decent amount of hiring going on.
Just to make sure everyone knows what FAANG is, if you want to explain that.
Sure. It's Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google.
So the really big tech companies. That that leads us to another question, actually. Thanks for that, Sungjin. But so there are top tech companies out there. There's also startups, you know, that are very innovative. You have an opportunity to do a lot with a startup. You have an opportunity to learn a lot in the tech companies. What are the pros and cons? This panel has a really wide range of experience working with both some small and some pretty big companies. Can you characterize the pros and cons? Do you want to start that off, Sanjin?
Sure. I think this is going to be a very personal choice. I mean, let me just make a, you know, fairly general statement. Going to a startup is, you know, very high risk and very high return opportunity. The chance of success is probably not very high. But also, if the company succeeds, the chance of getting a pretty high return, you know, financial return to begin with, is going to be also very high. So if you are at a position in your life where you can definitely take that risk, then, you know, startups can be a choice for you. But again, I think juxtaposing the current coronavirus situation where probably things like private equity and venture capital might be a little bit dry, that may be a bit of a consideration here. So just a side note there. If you don't think that, you know, you can really stomach the risk, then probably you may want to think about other more established companies in this particular time. So again, I think this is going to be really coming down to your sort of personal appetite for risk and the type of sort of entry into the industry as you go into it, and you know what you want to do to begin with.
Thanks.
So I can jump in. I agree with the risk and return profile characterization. I would add like a couple of thoughts. Like one is that I really do think that early in your career, especially learning well, is the most important thing. And I really believe that mid-sized companies and up are better places to start learning than startups. They tend to have better support. They have better mentorship relationships. As a person who is hiring a lot of people for a startup, like one of the things I'm very cognizant of is that I don't have engineers who can mentor newer engineers. Like I just don't have the capacity for it. And so I'm not going to do it. And if I did, I could probably hire some, you know, cheaper, less experienced engineers, but they would have a bad experience. And that will change as we get bigger, but so forth. Another thing I think that people should consider, which I think that they don't often, is that especially early in your career, you want to balance breadth of new technologies and getting experience with lots of different things, and also like going deep enough to actually really benefit from having learned them. And I think that there's an option here that people neglect, which is that there are a lot, even in, especially in Chicago, there's a lot of very good technology-focused consulting companies that are, I think, pretty good options for new grads. So I'm talking about places like Pivotal, ThoughtWorks, 8th Light, DevMind. There's a bunch of boutique ones like DevMind, and I don't know, there's a lot of them. Oh, TableXI, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing about these places is that like they are technology-focused consultancies. It's not like Accenture where it's like they do everything. And so they're very, very much like on the cutting edge of new trends and technologies. But they're also like the fundamental dynamic of a consultancy is that its only product is its people. And so they tend to have pretty good training programs. ThoughtWorks used to do this thing where they would send you to India for 2 months for training, just like in the boot camp and stuff. I don't think I do that anymore, but it sounds kind of cool. And also, like, frankly, there might be travel, and you probably are better able to handle a travel earlier in your career. So I just think it's a thing that, like, when you say startup versus big company, that is the long-term dynamic, I think, definitely. But I would, especially early on, consider a stint in consulting. Don't do it for too long.
Great. Thank you. I have a question directly from Mayank requesting, can you talk more about your internship experiences and what resources you utilized as a student?
My project was on developing a full stack web application for internal pricing tool for saving cost of the engineering division, and we have used technologies such as Node.js in JavaScript, MongoDB database, and uploading data to server via FTP, integration of Kubernetes, and some distributed tracing framework developed by Uber. So it was basically crude stuff, creating retrieval, update, and deletion on the database. Yeah.
Thank you. Let's try to tackle a couple quickly. Are there any suggestions that anyone has for people who are about to start their first job? Any bullet points to throw out?
I would say, if you can, depending on where you're working, if you can find someone who's like adjacent to your team but not on your team to serve as a mentor, I think that is a really key aspect of like improving and growing in your role. If you can just find someone to sort of like coach you on like some soft skills and leadership and interaction and maybe how to leverage and move up the ladder and really make yourself noticeable and dynamic. I think having a mentor is a really solid thing to do. Yeah.
Great, thank you. So there's a question about the types of questions in an interview that folks should be able to answer about technologies that they list. So if you're participating in an interview with a candidate who is identified certain technologies, what are the sorts of things you want them to be able to say? That, I mean, let's say take programming languages, right? If someone has a programming language on there, now, and we had specified earlier, right, not all of the panel when they're interviewing is focused really on the specific technical skills for all jobs, But that said, if someone claims to be, let's say, a Python programmer or a Java programmer, what are the sorts of aspects of that language that you would expect them to be especially strong on? Do you have an opinion on that, Mayank?
Yeah, so I would say that, let's say, for example, you have written Python in your resume. So you should know that, you should know the basic stuff of Python, like how to create dictionaries Python, how to create a list in the Python, how to add a new item in the list in the Python. So basically, you should know that interviewer expect you to know all the basic stuff of a language. And it should not be any advanced feature of that language, but you should know that how to write a basic program and basically how to solve basic algorithmic questions using that language.
Okay, great. How about questions of salary when you start talking? Is there any advice on salary negotiation? I think, you know, obviously it's a topic that everyone is interested in and is often very difficult to tackle. From your perspective, from the other side of the table, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I guess I would say, from kind of here, as I mentioned, I do quite a lot of recruiting. I probably am engaged in at least one fairly serious salary negotiation every 3 days at work right now, at the rate we're hiring and making offers. And I'd say candidates are really bad at them. It's remarkable. This is one of these things where just like, it's like we're riding bikes and I'm a person who has like ridden a bike once a week for 10 years. And they're just like, they've done it. This is their second time riding a bike. It's not that I'm like smarter. It's just that I literally just have done this so many more times that I just have this like unbelievable advantage at doing it. I would just say like read one of the million blog posts on how to do this out there and follow it. Remember that by the time you have gotten to this stage, the company has decided that it wants you. And it's very unlikely that they would walk away from making you an offer based on the fact that you're negotiating. And then, yeah, just like follow the very, very simple advice of like, don't say a number first. I very frequently, like here, the literal script that I run through is like, hey, we decided to make you an offer. Great, congrats, blah, blah, blah. Or maybe early in this process, I'll have said in Illinois now and in California, this will probably become effectively nationwide because of California kind of like leading the country in how labor laws work. But, you can't ask someone's previous salary. So I would say like, hey, what would you be expecting to make? And, you know, I have different pay bands and I'm probably going to slot them into a pay band or something like that, but then there's wiggle room. And so 85% of the time, I have a spreadsheet of this and I'm not going to check it right now, but I'm willing to bet that it's like on my spreadsheet, if I just tabulated it out, 85% of the time someone immediately responds with a number. Don't do that. Like say whatever it is that you can say on these blog posts. Say, I'm just sort of really excited about the role. We can talk about this later. Like I'd be really curious to see what you all were thinking, that sort of thing. Because I don't know, like there definitely is a market, but you don't know what your counterparty is thinking. And you might really seriously undervalue yourself if you go first. So yeah, I don't know. I would say there's a lot of blog posts in this. Please read them. Do not assume that you'll be able to just wing it. People are so bad at this. It's amazing.
It's a fair summary. Thank you. Go ahead, Sangjin. Looks like you come off mute.
Yeah. So again, 100% agreed with what Lionel just said. And also, one thing I'll say is, you know, actually salary and level is another thing. You know, people also get in a pretty passionate about which level that they go in. What I'll say is also think of the bigger picture. And if the company really wants you, and the company wants you to succeed, then, and also, you know, if you actually got a certain salary figure and certain sign-on bonus and thing, and equity and things like that, you know, as you do well in the company, you will quickly get more salary increases, promotion and things like that. Those are bound to come. And, maybe in a couple of years, you may even forget what your starting salary was. So, going in, I definitely understand things like the starting level and the salary and exactly how much sign-on bonus I got. It seemed really, really important. And of course they are important, but it is really the first step in your sort of journey within the company. And over time, the sort of importance of that will start fading a little bit. So just, you know, think about that sort of long view and the big picture, and, you know, just have that a little bit of peace of mind. Maybe having, you know, let's say 5,000 less may not be a deal breaker one way or the other.
Great, thank you. All right, we are coming up quickly to our hard stop for the end of this. Is there any final words of advice that you'd like to give? I'm just going to run through and see if any of you have any summative statements, or if not, you know, just any encouragement or general ideas you could offer to our attendees. Mayank, let's start with you. Is there any final words that you want to share?
Yeah, so I would say if you are not getting the job, just keep trying. So when I was applying for internships, I was not getting calls. So I applied in basically 150 companies, and I got a job. I got internship offer from only two companies. So just stay hopeful and keep trying. Yeah.
Thank you. Lionel?
Yeah, I would agree with Mayank. I think it's like, if you're graduating right now, you have lost the random, like, is there a recession when I graduate from whatever lottery? I was in a pretty similar position when I finished college. I graduated, I graduated in 2011. So it's like, we're into the recovery by that point. But yeah, I mean, like, keep at it. Like, you will find something. You are, like, very well-trained, talented people. Eventually, you're going to be okay. But yeah, definitely have some empathy for you for now.
Thanks. Alyssa, what would you want to share?
I guess that I just want to say applying for a job in this industry can be very hard for women, genderqueer folks, minorities, etc. There are a lot of resources out there for support if you fall into one of those categories. I would say that don't give up. One of the biggest shocking pieces of data that I learned is that people who identify as female don't often apply for jobs unless they fit like 90% of the criteria, while people identifying as male apply when they hit half or even less. So apply for the jobs. All the women on this call, apply for jobs that you don't think you have all the qualifications for, because you might get it, because other people are applying for those jobs with even less, fewer qualifications than you. You can do it. Just send out your resumes. It can be tough, but I have hope that the industry is changing for the better.
Very important advice. Thank you. Sungjin, we're down to the wire. What can you share with us?
Yeah, I think I'm actually echoing the same theme here. Have an optimistic outlook. Things look kind of bleak in terms of a lot of things that are going on right now, but, you know, I'm actually, you know, pretty positive that, this audience will have a great success. Another interesting thing about the software industry is that it changes so rapidly. So it basically is inherently a very level playing field. It is just wide open to people who are hungry to always be learning. So if you have that sort of mindset of just in a growth mindset, learning mindset, you know, what you know now will be obsolete in probably a couple of years. So always just maintain that learning outlook and just, you know, maintain that optimistic outlook. I think, you know, good things will happen.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank all of the attendees for your participation in this. All of the panelists, thank you so much for your insight and the experience that you brought to this and the help that you've offered. And thanks, Brianna and Josh, for everything that you've done to make this possible. Brianna, do you have any closing to give?
Just to say, express lots of gratitude. Thank you so much for all of you being here today, sharing your experiences. It's just really great to be able to pass along this information to students and postdocs who are trying to navigate this whole process. So thank you so much for your time. I did put something into the chat about potentially connecting through the University of Chicago WISER network, so to continue conversation. So for our alums, if you don't have a profile there, I'd encourage you to set one up, and hope that the rest of you stay safe, stay healthy, and have a good rest of your Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.